Okay, 9 through 12. Healing of the blind man, raising of Lazarus, good shepherd discourse. And the final section then of the first part of the gospel. Well, Mr. Childs, either you did really well or you're just giddy with pain. I don't know what it is. Oh, just remember, do what I say and not what I do, all right? I do. Nuts. Okay, any quizzes outstanding yet? That is to say, that you still have in your hand? Okay, any questions that you have before we restart? All right, just some very brief introductory things, just to make sure you have some primary stuff, as it were. As you read John's Gospel and look at the text critical apparatus, what manuscripts might you especially pay attention to in John's Gospel for primary best readings? Maybe. What's the symbol for Aleph? Oh, it's Aleph. Uh-huh. Is there a name with Aleph, Mr. Sabal? Huh? Right, Sinaiticus. It starts with an A, right? Look, you guys, there's guys in St. Louis here. They already realize, by way of reputation, okay? So kind of try to do your best, right? And that means, let's see, Bill Sabal is not to be called upon again, all right? We'll just make a list. We'll make a list of problem people here. Well, okay, what year does Alexandrinus come from? Yeah, 4th century. It's one of those major texts, apparently commissioned by Constantine. Maybe a 4th century text isn't the best reading. Why not? I mean, especially a text like this, or Sinaiticus maybe even too. No, it's a standardized text, for one, because of Constantine's desire to have an authoritative text. What is the very earliest text that we have that has anything of John on it? No.
75.
No.
72.
Not 72, but 52. Yeah. P52. Where does that come from? Yeah, probably maybe even earlier. A lot of text critics would put it even earlier, maybe 110 or so. You have some very brief comments from John's Gospel in P52. I've forgotten exactly the verses. Just might be of interest to you. By the way, gentlemen, I don't know if you are familiar with this little book. I think it's a very interesting and helpful book by Philip Comfort. Are you familiar with this? C-O-M-F-O-R-T, Philip Comfort, Early Manuscripts and Modern Translations of the New Testament. And he has some very nice pages descriptive of major manuscripts. Okay. So in terms of John's Gospel, P52, where are we here? Here we are. Yeah, just some passages from John 18, 31 to 34 and 37 to 38. So just about five verses dated around 110. P5 would be another early one. And then somebody's mentioned it, P66 and P75. Now, all of these come from Egypt. That's an accident of history because of the weather there. But my tendency is, this me, that if you have an agreement with P66 and 75, that's probably an extremely strong reading. And 75 is better than 66. 66 has multiple corrections. 75 tends to be the stronger of the two papyri. Both have extensive portions of John in them. All right? So pay special attention to P66, even more P75. But absolutely also those major uncials, they're always to be taken into consideration. Okay. What I also wanted you to take a look at, and I just gave you referencing from Barrett's commentary, has to do with some of the literary style of the Gospel of John. What are some of the stylistic characteristics of John? Did you happen to take a look? Okay, sentences just that come one after another, that's called the sundeton. Okay? So sentences that simply come one after the another, often without any kind of connecting word. Another way in which he structures his sentences is by way of parataxis. What's that? Yeah, by chi. So in John's Gospel, you'll have an awful lot of connecting of sentences simply with chi. And that means that this chi, well, you just have to make up your mind as you read the text, whether this chi, in fact, is coordinating, whether it's simply a structural element, just connecting sentences together, or what its thrust is, what its resonance is in the text. You just have to make up your mind. But you need to be aware that parataxis is a common Johannine way of constructing his text, parataxis. Not so much, no. Not so much in his epistles. Then there is also the use of un, therefore, which in John's Gospel loses virtually all kind of logical connecting force. Okay. So you just need to be aware of this. And again, you have to make up your mind whether such force obtains or no. This particle, I'm just looking, comes from Barrett. I haven't counted myself. He says something like 190 occurrences of something like 303 occurrences of un in the New Testament are from John's Gospel. That's a high predominance. But it's simply due to the structural character of him using this as a linking particle. So it loses all argumentative force. Then such words such as ekenos, he, or that one, is often used in John's Gospel, as well as the possessive pronouns such as emos, emu, emon, whatever the case may be. This is very characteristic of John. And then an interesting form, now you just take a look at Barrett. I'm not going to go all the way through him because that's what you guys are supposed to do. But what Barrett calls the epexegetic hina or hati, this explanatory phraseology, is characteristic of John's Gospel as well. But I do want you to be aware of the specifics of John's vocabulary. And I don't want to, again, spend a lot of time with this, but in Barrett, he gives a nice little listing, partial, on pages 5 and 6 of those words which are characteristic of John, not characteristic of the synoptics, as well as some that are characteristic of the synoptics, and not characteristic of John. Jessica, what are the synoptics? When I say the synoptics, what am I talking about? Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that's right. I just wanted to make sure everybody knew it. You never know. For example, the verb to love, agapon, in the entirety of John, 44 occasions, more than in all of the synoptics put together. The word for truth, 46 times in John, only 10 times in all of the synoptic gospels. Gnosko is another Johannine term. Zoe, as one might expect, also. Cosmos, think of it. Cosmos, 78 times in John's gospel. According to Barrett, only 13 times in the synoptic texts. Okay. Pater, 118 times. Almost more than anywhere else, not only anywhere else, but all the rest of the New Testament put together, as we mentioned last time. Phos, okay. Concerning the synoptic expressions that are rare in John, something like the word euangelion, John doesn't have the term. Kalein, kerusein, John doesn't have kerusein. Or the word for repentance, metanoia, not in John. Okay. So there's a lot of difference. Dunamis, dikaios, not Johannine terms. So just take a look at these pages from Barrett. I give them to you not just as a friendly suggestion, so to speak. Okay. Okay, in John 7:53 to 8:11, we have a story. What is it? Yeah, the woman caught in adultery. From very early on, it was, I say very early on enough, it was placed in John's gospel. I say placed, what would you say? Misplaced in John's gospel. Probably so. I don't know if I refer you to Bruce Metzger's little book, Textual Commentary on the Greek New Testament. Are you familiar with this little book? Okay. It's a very helpful book. And what are some of the reasons which Metzger gives that would argue against the authenticity of this story in John's Gospel? Okay, you have non-Johannine terminology there. There's nothing characteristic of John's language in this text. It clearly breaks the flow of John's own narrative, which is easily discernible if you would simply skip it and read continuously in John's Gospel at that point from 752 to 812. And then the manuscript evidence is overwhelmingly against it. None of the earliest witnesses, some of which we have on the board, have it. P66 not, P75 not, Alexandrinus not, Washingtonian not. All of those do not have it. And then it has no certainty within the textual tradition, such as it is. And it even finds itself placed in one other gospel in some manuscripts. And what other gospel is that? Luke. Yeah. So it is what appears to be an authentic piece of Jesus material, but it doesn't find its place authentically in John's gospel. So we won't be considering it should regard it as a non-Johannine and probably synoptic-like tradition. All right.
You said it's an authentic piece of Jesus' material?
Yeah, I would agree, and I think most people do agree with what Metzger says, that it has all the earmarkings of authentic report. Okay? It's the kind of thing that Jesus did, as we know from other narrative. It's the kind of thing Jesus says. So there's no reason to doubt that it's just purely legendary or something like that. Okay. All righty. Okay, any questions on any of this introductory stuff? Again, you have the text before you. Please look at them. All right. All right, I mentioned to you last time that we're going to assume that you're reading the commentary, but that when I give my own, and of course, I give you the study questions so you can work through stuff, I do like the idea that you might have some ideas of your own. Okay. This is a good thing. Okay. But when I express my ideas, it's going to be by and large with the assumption that John's gospel is written early, that it's written in Jerusalem, that it is written for and unto, if you will, the Jews of the synagogue in order to convince them that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. That is to say that he is the bearer of the end time spirit. And that coming to such conviction in Jesus or concerning Jesus, they would come to Christian baptism. So that there is a distinctly baptismal character to John's gospel, and I think that is, to my mind at least, quite evident throughout the gospel. Not the least reason of or evidence for which is the overwhelming use of father-son language in John's gospel, which is extremely important. And we know that to have baptismal context in early church writing and thinking. Okay, but I'm not the only one to think that John's gospel is early. If you would read commentaries written in the early part of this century, say through the 50s, the general view of John's gospel would be that it was the last of the gospels, written in the 90s. Some people would have thrown this even into the early second century. In fact, in the 19th century, it was not hard to find scholarship that would have put John's gospel further into the second century, all the way out to 170, according to a German scholar by the name of Schmiedel. It was, in fact, then the discovery of P52, which is to be dated again around the year 110, that put the terminus ad quem at that date. Okay. And that means that John finds its way to Egypt, presumably to Egypt, at a very, very early period of time. So John's gospel was nonetheless seen to be last of the gospels. Very often it was seen to be the least historical of the gospels. It was more contemplative. It was more, if you will, theological. It was something like Clement of Alexandria had called it, the spiritual gospel. It might be seen as trying to give a summation to the primary theological intentions of the more historical and traditional gospels of the synoptics. It was seen to be then largely disconnected from the actual history of Jesus. It was disconnected from eyewitness, despite what seemed to be its explicit claim. So all these things, and dependent, however, upon synoptic tradition with Johannine additions. And it was thought to be the least Jewish. Maybe Luke might compete with John for a Gentile character, but John's gospel was seen to be Gentile in its thrust. So much so that you could easily find commentary that would say that the Logos, or the use of the Logos in the prologue, was in fact an adaptation of Stoic Logos notions. I used to have a good colleague here, fellow great guy, actually. I always hate it when my senility begins to show in public. What was his name? Ah, my goodness. This is really quite amazing. Well, I can't tell you. I just got off the phone with my daughter. At least I remembered her name. This is a. But anyway. Well, thank you for this hopeful comment. You know, it's. But anyway, he took his degree from classics from Chicago University, and his doctoral dissertation was on Stoicism and. And John's Gospel was sitting right in there. You know. But that's not true anymore. With the, especially the discovery of the Qumran documents, the reassessment of John's Gospel has proceeded apace. And in a very, well, at the time, important article, John A.T. Robinson listed six different ways in which John was being reassessed by New Testament scholarship. I'll just mention a few. First of all, it became more and more clear that John was a Jewish gospel, that it was pervaded by Jewish conceptuality and Jewish language, and that it was, in fact, almost certainly addressed to a Jewish audience. The idea today that, or today, the idea that John's Gospel was written for a Gentile audience is very hard to find in contemporary scholarship. That is very, very different, however, than how things were 30 or 40 years ago. But if directed to a Jewish audience, then the possibility of it being early rather than later also begins to be more in play. And it is by no means hard to find scholarship today which would think of John's Gospel as contemporaneous with Paul, and indeed written before the Synoptic Gospels. Now, in J.A.T. Robinson's fine book, The Priority of John, he does not primarily mean that it was written first, although he leaves that as an open possibility. But he has in mind something different, and which is, again, something new in Johannine scholarship within the last quarter century or so, and that is, to use Robinson's language, that John's Gospel is close to the source, by which he means, if anything, it is truer to the reality of Jesus' ministry than are the Synoptic Gospels. And we'll have occasion on a number of times to reflect a little bit upon this. Let me give you, though, a couple of examples. In John's Gospel, how many times does Jesus go to Jerusalem? Three, no. Or they presume could be, you could press four out of it maybe, but generally say three, okay. How many times in the synoptic accounts? One, okay. Well, clearly that's not the case. At least it would assume to be not the case, seem to be not the case. Why do the synoptics have only one? Okay. Yeah, certainly if Jesus dies, that tends to be the end of the story in a way, doesn't it? Sure, makes sense. And you could die only once, and that's in Jerusalem. In other words, thematic requirement brings them to speak of Jesus' ministry as a one-year event, okay, or at least a one-journey event to Jerusalem, but not John. John is probably truer to the truth. And indeed, you have this interesting phrase in Matthew's gospel, I think it is, where Jesus is said to have taken his disciples after the Last Supper, where? To the Mount of Olives, as was his custom, okay? And if this is just a one-time deal, this is a strange way of talking, okay? So even Matthew's account brings us into some insight that John's probably truer. And we'll also reflect upon this a little bit concerning the interesting fact that in John's gospel, the cleansing of the temple appears where? At the beginning, and in the synoptic accounts, obviously the only place it could, at the end, because they only have one journey to Jerusalem. Now, I suppose one can think about John's, of Jesus having cleansed the temple twice. According to my sermon of yesterday, Fred Dierlein cleaned his house only apparently once, all right? But it is at least conceivable that one might clean a house twice. That's possible. But it does seem a little strange to think of a kind of two-time deal with cleaning of the temple. We're going to give some, well, I'll give it now. The first four chapters of John have as one of their ongoing threads the relation of Jesus to John's baptism. Now, John is, as in the other Gospels, the first person on the scene. Jesus' baptism is the defining first narrative. But he is said to be a one sent from God. And what are the Old Testament texts that are especially adduced to speak of John the Baptist? I didn't hear you here. You didn't say anything. All those voices and you were quiet? Okay. Who? Was it you, Tim? Okay. Not Micah, but Malachi. All right, Bill Sable is there. Yes. Malachi. All right. Now I didn't bring my Old Testament because I tend to be Marcionite in my proclivities. But somebody may. Jessica did bring hers, but you don't need it. Okay? I need it. All right. And this is what we read in Malachi. Behold, I am going to, and this is directly said to be of John the Baptist in the New Testament documentations. I am going to send my messenger, and he will clear what? The way before me. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. All right? In other words, the connection between John's preparatory baptism and the Lord coming to his temple suddenly is at least thematically there in Malachi. But this is just me now, it makes sense to me that if Jesus in fact had this consciousness of himself as the one whom John prepares for, that the sign of his ministry may already be indicated by him suddenly coming to the temple. That was, in fact, the next, if you will, sign already indicated in Malachi. So there is every reason to believe, it seems to me, that the cleansing of the temple was, in fact, early in Jesus' ministry, and not, as one might assume in the synoptic accounts, at the end of his ministry. Obviously, it was in Jerusalem. Okay. So as long as you got Jesus in Jerusalem one time, and you want to talk about the cleansing of the temple, then you've got to do it there, obviously. So maybe John's gospel is truer to Jesus' ministry. It's just more expansive. It is more Jerusalem-based. And Jesus does seem to be known in Jerusalem. John's gospel reports that Jesus had a lot of disciples in and around Jerusalem. Maybe that explains why that Jesus had no difficulty, or his disciples had no difficulty finding an upper room. Okay. Or that when he sent two disciples into Jerusalem, they had no problem getting a donkey. Okay. I mean, if you're walking down the streets of Fort Wayne and a couple of blokes with beards and long cloaks come up to you and say, "Can we borrow your car? Because our master has need of it," I'm sure you're just going to say, "Of course, here are the keys," right? Well, I doubt whether they gave over their donkey just to two blokes that they didn't know. But if they kind of know where to look, they might well have an acquaintance or a friend or a disciple even who has a donkey. So there are some reasons to believe that Jesus, a lot of reasons to believe that Jesus had contact in Jerusalem, even as Peter and John did, as we shall see. Okay. On Sunday, is it not so that the NCAA pairings...
This is correct.
That is correct. Okay. You have my permission to stop studying John's gospel and reading your commentaries and working on your study questions in order to look at the NCAA slottings, okay? However, at the conclusion of that special broadcast, I will myself light up a cigar with a small glass of scotch, and I will go on my back porch in the certainty that all of you will have study questions for the prologue of John in your hand, and Ritterbos's commentary by your side, and Nestle's text in front of you, right?
In your backyard?
No. Now notice what I said. This is in front of you, and this is by your side, all right? All right? And we'll start with the study questions on the prologue, including a little Greek exercise. So read through it.